This is the Relevant Podcast.
It's episode 1086, and it's a Relevant Podcast. Here in Orlando, I'm your host, Cameron Strang, and joining me from Loverland, Virginia, it's Jesse Carey.
Hello, hello.
From Nashville, Tennessee, artist, producer, mogul, Derek Miner.
What up, dog?
And just down the road there in Nashville, our very own downtown Emily Brown.
Hey, y'all.
We have a great show in store for you. Coming up later, we talk to Upper Room, one of our favorite worship collectives. We also have your feedback and Relevant Buzz and all that. But before we get going,
I was going to say, it's Barbenheimer weekend.
Yes.
Who isn't excited about this? This is...
What weekend?
Derek's the one who's not excited.
Barbenheimer.
What is Barbenheimer?
Barbie and Oppenheimer.
How many... Like, I've talked to multiple people that are doing the double feature. And Oppenheimer, should be noted, is 3 hours long. And Barbie is clocks in, I think, just over two. So we're talking 5 hours...
Plus the gap in between.
Yeah.
You got,
and I've heard a lot of debates about this, whether if you're going to do this, which one. My thing is, you got to eat the steak before you have dessert. Like, it's clearly an Oppenheimer Barbie situation. I know a lot of people going Barbie.
Because who's in the mood for atomic bombs like in the morning? You know what I mean? No, you got to start the day light. And then you eat nighttime. You do your heavy lifting. I don't know. I think. I see both.
I think the people who do Barbie first and then Oppenheimer, it's like, if you start with Oppenheimer, then you're going to be thinking about atomic bombs while you're watching a Barbie movie, because you're still going to be like in that.
It's a palate cleanser. It's the limoncello after you had the pasta.
Hopefully that you're risking it, though, because it also seems like
Derek is
Barbie
like
does get a little Derek, bit.
Look at his face. I've never seen
it. Derek. I've never seen you more disinterested.
Less interested than ever. And there have been a lot of things that we've talked about that he sits back. He like gets up, goes to the restroom. He doesn't care. This is another level of disinterest. He almost fell asleep.
Do you have interest in either of these films?
In no shape, form, or fashion.
Dude, this weekend is going to save Hollywood. Like, every movie that's come out so far has been a disappointment. You know, Indiana Jones was a flop, and The Flash, and all the others. And this is the one. This weekend saves Hollywood, they say. So we'll see.
While the actors are on strike and the writers.
Well, this is really going to be like the big last kind of like Hollywood weekend for a while, I think, because of the strike. Like, I mean, no one's doing any press. There's not going to be any like new film. I mean, there will be new films coming out, but there's no promo for them. Like, this is kind of like the one last hurrah before.
Here's my suggestion.
400 years of silence.
Here's my suggestion, because I think if either of these movies were coming out independently, like, there would still be people would still be excited that wanted to see Barbie movie are going to go see Barbie movie. People that want to see Oppenheimer. But if there was like a 3 week gap, I don't think people would have, it wouldn't be like memeified like it is right now. I read somewhere that they've sold like 40,000 double feature tickets.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, that people are just going to sit in a theater for over 5 hours watching these just because it's kind of a cultural moment.
That's wild.
So I had an idea with.
So the two movies together are basically one Avengers movie. Derek likes like about 5 hours total.
Yeah.
It would be like
seeing Infinity War and Endgame.
At least there's explosions.
Hey, there is an Oppenheimer.
Spoiler alert for the end of Oppenheimer. I think I know how that
I'm
works.
Just somebody asked me, it was Oppenheimer, and then it was the movie, I think, The Sound of Freedom.
Yeah.
And I said, they asked me, was I going to go see it? I was like, no. And it's not because I don't support, you know, Sound of Freedom or Oppenheimer. But I also don't go see like movies about slavery and the Civil War. Like, reality is real enough.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm being honest, I probably might would go see the Barbie thing a little bit, but it's just, it's Barbie. I'm not interested in no shape, form, or fashion about a Barbie movie. Like, there's nothing that's interesting to me. So
here's my idea though, because we do see there's an appetite for these like experiences, not just going to the movies, but making a day out of it, right?
Right.
Emily, to your point, there's a writer strike. There's an actor strike. The movies aren't being promoted. They're holding the release dates on stuff. We're going to see a pause. Why don't we just run back some movies and just like have a Chris Farley weekend across the country where for it's sure. like, I'm going to go, you know, watch, you know, Tommy Boy and Black Sheep back to back at some, you know, just all across the country. Why don't we just dust off a couple of fun double features from back in the day? Die Hard and Speed. Who's not going?
Me and my sons, this in the past 7 days, have watched The Waterboy, Liar Liar, and yesterday we just watched Major Pain.
Love it.
And Major Pain. It's been the best time in our lives. Like, they are dying laughing. I'm dying laughing from nostalgia. They're dying laughing because Damon Wayans and Jim Carrey and Adam Sandler are ridiculous. Like, so I'm with that. Like, that's my speed. Listen, for sure. I like that idea, Jesse.
If they next weekend were like, hey, we're going to do In the Army Now with Pauly Shore and Major Pain with Damon Wayans.
In there. I'm there.
Who's not going? I'm not going?
All day.
And everyone's going dressed in fatigues. Yes.
I'm there, bro.
What's funny
I'm
with
there.
Like,
if they did Juice and Boys in the Hood, I'm there.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then nightcap it with the other way. And it's like, don't be caught drinking a juice in the hood or whatever they're paired
exactly,
with.
Exactly.
That's the nightcap.
Or a Friday marathon on a Friday night.
All three Fridays on a Friday night. You know what I'm saying?
This could save Hollywood, guys.
I'm good. That's what I would do. Because I think that's a great point, Jesse. I think you're onto something, because now we don't necessarily care about going to the movies to see the newest thing. I think it's the experience of being in the theater now. Mm-hmm. Like the movies, it doesn't really matter. It has to be a cultural event. So it's like if the movie theaters created cultural events, I think that it would be dope. Okay, we're remastering Friday or on, you know, around October, we're remastering the Friday the 13th and the Nightmare on Elm Streets and all of that. We're remastering them and putting them into the theaters for you to be able to experience them. And then those are our childhood. And then, Lord willing, you know what I mean? Yeah, well, I can see it.
World Series weekend. Throw out Rookie of the Year and Sandlot.
Oh, my God.
Little double feature action. Come on. I'm just saying.
NBA Finals, Air Bud, Space Jam? Like, what?
You go Space Jam.
What's the Whoopi Goldberg becoming the coach of the Knicks?
It's called Eddie.
That's it.
It's Eddie. She won a half court contest, become assistant coach for halftime. If I recall, which I'm pretty sure I do, she was attending a Knicks game. Like, it was a halftime contest, and you hit the half court shot. You got to sit on the bench as an assistant coach. Something transpired in the plot where I think the entire coaching staff was thrown out of the game. And Whoopi Goldberg, who plays a Knicks fan who won a contest, takes over for halftime of the team, inspires the team, and ends up becoming the full time coach. Isn't that the plot?
Yeah, I think it is.
Eddie and semi pro.
There you go.
Will Ferrell, Eddie and Semi-Pro. That Semi-Pro it's a slept on movie by Will Ferrell.
Oh, that's great.
Everyone talks about Step Brothers and Talladega Nights. Semi-Pro is up there too.
Yeah, the Flint Tropics, man.
Well, there's a baseball movie, Little Big League. I don't know if you remember that one, where the kid inherits a baseball team from his grandfather. I think it's the Chicago Cubs, maybe, and somehow inserts himself into the lineup.
You know what baseball movie wrecked me, and I do not suggest
Major League.
Y'all watched
Angels in the Outfield.
Hardball.
Oh yeah.
When Keanu Reeves was the coach of the kids, man, go watch Hardball. It is one of the most moving movies. He takes over like a little, it's like Sandlot, but in the hood. Yeah. Via court order, he has to take all these young black kids and coach them and teach them baseball. And they just get to see kind of like the nuances of what's happening in the hood. Like, that movie wrecked me. It's a great movie.
Here's the other thing about that, the era of movies and sports movies in particular, the stakes were incredibly low. Like right now, when you go see a sports movie, somehow they end up playing to save the world, right?
What?
Like Space Jam.
Oh, Space Jam. Okay.
Or like this whole person's career and livelihood comes down to one putt. Like if they sink the putt or if they make the hoop, like everything in their life is all comes down to this one moment. The stakes were way lower in the 90s. I recently ran back the movie Major League with like Wesley Snipes and Charlie Sheen, like classic baseball movie. Yeah. They don't even show how the season ends. It ends with them winning the pennant, like winning their division. And that's good enough. We don't even know if they went to the World Series. We don't even know how they did in the playoffs. All we need to know, they made the playoffs. End of movie. That's how low the stakes are. We don't even know how the season ended. It was just a fun ride with
just a bit outside.
Yeah. We solved Hollywood. Just, we figured it out.
Well, they said...
Here's the thing. I think you do have to do sort of like a Barbenheimer feature, though, because all the movies you said sort of fit like the same genre. Like, I think you do have to throw, like, what's funny about the Barbenheimer stuff is people have brought up other instances in Hollywood where two major movies that had like very different demographics premiered at the same time. Like, I think it was like over 10 years ago, Mamma Mia and The Dark Knight premiered on the same weekend. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I think you got to do something like that.
So you're saying, because the guys were talking about theming it. So Friday 13th, Marathon, yeah, Halloween. Honest,
I'm not going to a single theater to see a sports movie.
Yeah, right.
Barely watch my couch.
What you want is the juxtaposition of genre.
So you're saying like, let's say it's like Father of the Bride and Last of the Mohicans. Like, let's do it.
Yes.
Let's do it.
Yeah, you got to pick like two almost ones that are like... If Shawshank Redemption and Legally Blonde,
back to back. There you go.
Oh, now that would be a fun back to back feature. I would see
because
that.
It's law and then prison. I mean, they kind of connect.
Yeah, they go together.
Yeah. All right. Well, moving the show along. Stay tuned. Up next. Oh, this might have been the opening item of Relevant Buzz. We just kind of plagiarized it. Sorry,
Emily.
No problem.
We're just on the same way. Two editors just on the same way.
Stay tuned. Up next, a off-the-cuff modified version of Relevant Buzz, because we just talked about the first item. Listening to Genesis Owusu. The song is Tied Up.
Where bold women thrive, Sweetbriar College empowers women to lead with purpose and integrity. Our 2,847-acre campus is more than beautiful. It's a place to grow in courage, character, and calling. With hands-on academics, a close-knit community, and spaces like vineyards, greenhouses, and equestrian arenas, Sweetbriar blends tradition with vision. Founded in 1901, we've always believed in the power of women to shape a better world, faithfully, fearlessly, and together. Find out more at sbc.edu.
Okay, it's time for
Relevant Buzz.
All right, tell us what's happening at the intersection of faith and culture this weekend, Emily.
Besides Barbie and Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
All pop culture paused, by the way. There's nothing else happening.
I mean, kind of.
Everyone said we're sitting on the sidelines this weekend.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, it's been on my calendar for a while. I'll be honest. I'm seeing Barbie Thursday night at 6 p.m. because I don't want it ruined for me at all. So I have to be the first one to see it.
But you're like the person who does their Black Friday shopping on Thanksgiving at noon. Like you're going to the Walmart.
No,
right
don't
then.
Put that on me. No. I have strong feelings about those people. That's we have to save that for actual Black Friday talk. We can't talk about it now.
Wow. I didn't realize.
Okay. I didn't realize how strongly I felt until you called me that, and I don't like that.
She was like, don't you call me that. Don't you get the dirty words out your mouth.
I respect the holiday.
The meanest thing you could ever say to me. No. No, but we are talking about how this kind of is the last, Barbenheimer is kind of the last big Hollywood event for a while because Hollywood is basically shutting down for a while. There's a major strike that's been happening really since May when the writer's strike began, but last week actors joined them. So all that to say, we're not going to get a lot of new stuff from Hollywood for a while, except there have been a few exemptions. And one that we wanted to note was The Chosen was granted an exemption. So they will continue to produce their fourth season. Initially, they announced that they didn't have the exemption. But then after a few days of behind the scenes discussions, they reached an interim agreement, which means that the production company, because it's independent, they get to sort of decide some things separate from other studios. And so they have agreed to meet some of the requests from the union, including an 11% raise for all of the actors.
But what was said was that the independent studio separately agreed to the terms that the actors union was asking for. Mm-hmm. So the big studios are fighting back against those terms, but The Chosen said, no, we'll pay those terms. And so they got the exemption. So they gave them everything they asked for to That's finish dumb. The season. Yeah.
That's dope. I wish music would do this.
What do you mean?
Because. Right? Yes.
Oh, because of the streaming payment. So, yeah.
Oh,
bro. Yeah, like, I'm not even going to lie.
And it's a broken system.
The whole system's broken. Yeah. Music, like, I'm watching artists that are really, really popular, and some of them still living with their mom. And it shouldn't be that way.
Right.
It's almost like, for me, you know, music. Yeah, it's we need to do something.
Is there a comparable?
Kudos to the actors.
I was just going to ask, like, for music stream, like, I don't know much about music streaming. So, like, you know, how much do you get from streaming at all? Like, what are you hoping changes in the industry?
Well, it's not just streaming. I mean, I'm not going to just blame it all on streaming. Like, honestly, right. Streaming, it's a catch-22, right? So with an artist, like, there's fans I would have never had without streaming. Because there's people that would have never taken the chance to listen to the music, et cetera, et cetera. But do I feel like we need a raise there? Absolutely, for sure. But I don't think that it's just streaming. Think about it. Even social media, like, if I have 1 million views on an Instagram video, I should get paid a significant amount of money. Like, it shouldn't be a small amount. Like, even on social media streams, quote unquote streams, right? So, but it's bad. I mean, it's less than a penny per play, to be real.
Is there a comparable? I mean, the reason why Hollywood can do this is because if you want to work as an actor or as a crew member or a writer, you have to join the union. I mean, you just have to. Mm-hmm. And so
the part of the guilds,
right? So the guilds can dictate terms with the studios collectively. There's nothing like that at the Grammys, the Recording Association. There's nothing like that in the music industry.
Nah, so I'm chair of the Recording Academy. So the point of the Recording Academy, or I'm a chair in Nashville, the Recording Academy, it advocates for sure. It's going to advocate, but the thing we know that pushes the ball forward is what's happening now. There's not going to be any more movies, guys, until we get our terms. You know,
right.
That's what moves the ball.
Right.
Whether you advocate for higher royalty rates or whatever, we just did. I'm proud of the Grammys for doing this. The Music Modernization Act. We were a big advocate to push that forward. You know what I mean? So that was a very important thing as far as publishing is concerned, making sure these writers get paid. But that's the reason why music can't strike, because there's not a collective, like, we're not going to make music or not going to release albums unless you meet our terms. And the reason why is because music is so low budget to create. Even an independent film is going to cost a significant amount of money to create.
$2 million.
So yeah. So I think music, it's so quick. I mean, guys are making albums for $1,000. You know what I'm saying? At least in beats for $50 or whatever. There's always going to be, no matter if all the big artists say we're not going to do anything, there's just a bunch of young kids that, you know, make music off their phones and blow up. I mean, well, we kind of saw what that looked like during the pandemic. Like, new stars were created in the music industry during the pandemic. I don't know if y'all realize that, but the biggest artists, the Kendricks, the Kendricks, the Drakes. Well, Drake's always dropping, but the Kendricks, the J. Cole's, all of the big artists, none of them really dropped. So it made way for a lot of these younger artists to kind of, you know, fly their wings. And I think that's the issue with music.
Yeah, I mean, look at Billie Eilish. Her and her brother, you know, became two of the biggest pop stars in the world, literally in their parents' bedroom with laptops. You know what I mean? Yep.
Post Malone, but, you know, all the SoundCloud rappers. I mean, like, there's
Juice WRLD, RIP.
The thing is, like, interestingly, I think the platform that is going to provide the most equitable model moving forward is probably something like YouTube, where you know, creators on YouTube can make legitimate income, whether you're a musician or whether, you know, you don't have to be at Mr. Beast level to make, you know, a pretty good money on YouTube if you make quality content, because their rev share with creators, you know, with the, you know, it's built on the most sophisticated ad platform ever created because it's owned by Google. And their decision early on to share and let you see how much of the ad revenue you're getting for each piece of content that you put on the platform that does well, Derek, to your point, like on Instagram or these other platforms where content that fuels the, you know, engagement, which the company makes money off of, isn't shared back with the consumer. Something like YouTube has really paved a way for what the future of independent media creation could potentially look like, because their rev shares are so transparent, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, as far as artists, that's, I agree with you. I think the ad share on YouTube makes a whole lot of sense. But yeah, kudos to the actors. Kudos to the writers. I think standing up and saying, you know what, we're going to strike, I think that's really important, because these movie companies are making gobs of money, and there's no reason why the actors shouldn't be getting a raise and getting paid. So the writer and the writers as well. So kudos.
Emily, what was that one Hollywood exec like in this last year got like $500 million of like income or something?
Oh, David, Zaslav, how do you say his name?
Yeah, like these Hollywood. That's the thing, is like these studio execs are like making a ton of money, and they're literally, the actors are and the writers are going like, if you could just make $400 million instead of $500 million for your salary, we could pay for thousands of people to have a, you know, livable wage. Well, you know,
exactly.
Well, not only that, but top level, top tier talent too. I mean, like you know, you look at the recent layoffs at ESPN, you know, which is owned by Disney. You know, the fact that they could cut six on-air personalities who make, you know, eight-figure or more, you know, revenue and save, you know, countless dozens and dozens of production jobs, I think the pendulum's going to swing a little. I mean, right now you're seeing actors and writers, you know, but I don't think the average actor, the average writer isn't making this, you know, these crazy levels of income. But when you look at the top tier, that's when you all, that's the other inequity you see. Like, yeah, obviously on the executive level. But then when you see one on-air talent making, you know, in 1 year as much as every production member on the entire staff of a cable company, you know, I think things are going to start to level out, because the whole business model of how we consume content is rapidly, rapidly changing, you know?
Yeah, and I think we also have to make no mistake, though, right? People are coming, they're watching First Take for Stephen A. Smith. Like, they want to see. So he deserves to get a high amount of money, right? And, like, they're not, and this is unfortunate, but the production guy can get swapped out. So
that's true, but it's true. It's the tier under the Stephen A's, like the people who you know are not replaceable, but like it's complicated, but I think a leveling out, whether it's on the executive level or on like top tier talent level, where you see, you know, like I said, kind of incomes match, you know, what people bring to the table, I think we're going to see it more and more, especially now that, like I said, the business model is changing really, really rapidly.
I think your point is right. Like, you know, I think a lot of times when we think of actors, we think of like, you know, the 30 actors that we can name, but the Actors Guild has 160,000 actors in it. I can't name 160,000 people, you know? And so it's like, those, it's like, I don't even know if I can name 160. You know, like there's so many people that need, need someone to advocate for them. And it starts from the top, you know, from these high profile actors saying, no, I'm not going to promote my major movie because I want you to get paid. But it is even interesting. A lot of actors have been very transparent with their pay and their residuals that they've received. And it's like shocking how there's some actor, like there was one actress who, was on the show Orange is the New Black, which was major on Netflix. And she wasn't a main star, but she was in every episode.
No. She was in 46 episodes. She was the Asian girl. I'm forgetting her name, her character name.
Her real name's Kimiko Glenn.
Right.
But I don't remember her name in the show.
Yeah.
She was there. She was part of the crew, the show.
Who she is. And she said she made like $27 in residuals from the show the last, you know, like, and it's like she was a notable part of it. And you're getting $27
for the
and
year.
It's like, that is a show that put Netflix, like that really helped put Netflix on the map when it first came out.
She told the story how even the main stars, the core five or whatever, like when they were doing the red carpets and like the show had blown up and they were doing all these big events and premiering season two and all this stuff. Like she said, half the main cast was like bartending and working other jobs because they had to. It was not a livable wage coming from this hit show. And then the show would fly them out to do this big media events and stuff. Like they were Hollywood stars and they're going back to being a bartender the next day. It's crazy.
Yeah, the entertainment company is extreme, or entertainment business is so lopsided. And the thing is, this is the unfortunate part about it, even like with records. If I'm a businessman, right, and there's this artist that is unproven, doesn't have any success, I'm making their contract based on where they're at now. I'm not thinking what's going to happen if they're going to be Drake or if they're going to be J. Cole or if they're going to be the next Chris Evans or Chris Pratt, whatever, right? So whatever's happening in this movie is based on your worth now. Now, hopefully the success of the movie blows up, but that contract doesn't change.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It doesn't change. So I almost feel like there needs to be some sort of like scaling thing. Like if certain metrics are hit, hey, your scale bumps up. Everybody's scale bumps up like that. That's just logic. Like, that's not, because I mean, yeah, we can't blame an executive for protecting himself, because for every Orange is the New Black, there's 20 other shows that sucked, right? That didn't do well. But when you have a hit like that, it can't just be like, all right, well, you know, hey, there's no scale. There's no nothing. Your face is plastered all over everywhere, but you don't get to participate in all of that. You know, that's not right. It's not right at all.
And I think a lot of these shows too, like, it's interesting with Netflix too. They honestly do a lot of shows where the actors are really not known. Like, you know, HBO, Apple TV Plus, like they're really good about getting big stars. A lot of the shows on Netflix are like young kids who are just trying to make it in the industry. And it's like, they're nobodies. So they sign a contract where it's like, you're saying they're signing a contract for what they're worth now, but then the show blows up and it's like, well, they don't have anything to, you know, kind of compensate them for like how much they've helped out Netflix and, you know, gotten them this free promo and stuff. And yeah, it's all just very backwards. It's interesting.
All right. What else we have?
Switching gears. We talked a few episodes ago about the student loan forgiveness plan and how the Supreme Court decided to strike down Biden's loan forgiveness plan. And in the weeks since, there's been a lot of discussion about it. And Axios actually did a poll among Gen Z just to get their opinion on that decision, since they're going to be, you know, the most affected by it. To absolutely no surprise, only 17% of Gen Z agreed with the decision. The majority were not thrilled that they will have to pay back their student loans. But they had, you know, a few follow-up questions, and there was one that really stuck out to me. They asked Gen Z who was responsible for their student loans not being forgiven, and 47% blamed the Supreme Court, while 38% blamed Republicans for their unforgiven student debt.
Let me ask clarity. So the question that they asked was, who do you blame for that not being forgiven? Because that is the Supreme Court. I mean, that...
Yes.
Okay. So it's not the question of who's responsible for you having no option but being saddled with this oppressive student loan debt.
Yeah.
So they're not blaming the Supreme Court Republicans for their their debt, they're blaming the Supreme Court for not forgiving the debt.
Who didn't get it pushed forward in the
Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, duh. So. Well, duh. I mean, the Supreme Court is the one who made the decision. So, yeah, blame them.
I don't know what the strategy is for conservatives and younger people. Because it don't look like they... like they have one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but your point, the follow up to this, like, is that exactly what you're saying is that when Gen Z, you know, 17% only 17% agree with the conservative court and what Republicans are doing policy wise. Obviously, Gen Z has feelings about Roe v. Wade and all these things. Your point is dead on, because a lot of political forecasters are talking about the inevitable shift that's coming, where like conservatives have completely lost an entire generation. And it's like the tipping point is like right around the corner, where it's like not even going to be this 50-50 split that America has had. But like Gen Z has been so affected by conservative policies that almost like there's no going back or something.
Well, to the point where, you know, a presidential candidate has suggested raising the voting age to mid to late 20s, you know, as, you know, sort of the implication being, you know, that those are all lost anyway. But part of it's, you know, look, is messaging too. Like, you know, I you look at something like this student loan forgiveness. I don't really have a personal horse in the race, but I feel like the...
Come on, Mr. Libertarian. How do you feel about it?
Well, I'm not opposed to debt forgiveness or the government giving money back to people who are taxpaying citizens.
Who are paying the money in.
Exactly. I have no opposition to that. But
giving us our money back.
But I hadn't heard the case of like, well, look, why that debt? You know what I mean?
Right, for sure.
You know, those are people who are
mortgages. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. but what I'm saying is like those debt holders have college degrees and could be, you know, set up to advancing in careers, where a lot of debt holders don't even have that advantage. Like there just wasn't, I feel like, and maybe this is just a little kind of our being in the era of social media, where everything has to be articulated in the length of a tweet or a TikTok video or an Instagram post, and that kind of leads to like a lot of platitudes, a lot of like oversimplification like of ideas, where you have to just distill it really quickly. But I feel like there's too many high profile political voices that lean into that will just distill everything into like a chant or a phrase or whatever it is without getting into the nuances of an issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'd be nice to see the pendulum swing the other way to a degree, where you'd actually have politicians go sit down for long form. Like there's a reason, I know it's like a controversial figure, but there's a reason someone like, you know, the Joe Rogans and Mark Marins of the world, you know, have such big platforms and have been successful in podcasting, because people are willing to go on there and talk for 3 straight hours and have a nuanced conversation about a lot of different topics. Like if you listen to a writer sit down with Mark Maron, you feel like you actually knew them and understand the nuances of their work, because it wasn't just tell us 5 policies. If we had like politicians and leaders and lawmakers sit down for lengthy interviews where they're willing to be somewhat vulnerable, I think people would have a lot more understanding of the core of the position instead of just trying to distill it into a video that's going to play well on Twitter, which is what we see. You know what I mean? Like, I think if you went back to that, like I said, those examples of just people in different fields being willing to sit down and be vulnerable and honest and have a real conversation with people, I think we would have a greater appreciation for both sides of an issue instead of it just being the lowest common denominator of what's going to either inflame people and cause them to get angry and confrontational, or cause them to kind of rally around something. I don't think it does justice to the nuances of policy, you know?
I think the reason I said the conservatives don't have a strategy for the youth, because I'm like, listen, all right, let's say student loan forgiveness, not a good thing, right? What I've noticed with my kids, or just with people in general, that if I say, no, you can't have that, and it's an actual real problem, then I'm going to say, you can't have that, but we can do this. Like, there's no compromise with any of these issues that Gen Z cares about. There's not even an understanding that those things even matter.
The gun reform.
And that's not, yeah, that's the problem. It's like, no, we're not reforming guns. It's not even like, hey, listen, we may not, we're not going to take away assault rifles, but hey, we're going to do this.
We'll do background checks.
We're not,
we'll do.
It's like the line is so heavy in the sand that it's like, yo. And I think it's, I think the liberals have that to a degree in certain areas as well, right? But I'm just like, but they appeal more to Gen Z though. So they're ensuring their future while conservatives, it feel like, are just like, hey, look, we run what we got. They got the Supreme Court. We got those are lifetime appointments. But it feels like that after that, there's no real plan to try to keep voters happy that are young, you know,
and younger people who are passionately pro-life feel further and further ostracized, like they don't belong anywhere because they also are affected by the decisions about student loan debt and the lack of gun control and like da, da, da. So it's like they care about other issues too, the climate. I mean, that's a huge one. Right. So it's like, okay, I'm pro-life, but I also care about climate change. I also care about gun safety. Where do I belong? Where do I vote? You know. It's kind of been our audience all along, but it's especially Gen Z seems to be affected. But,
I think Jesse, I think you do bring up a really good point about, from what I can see, the politicians, which are very far and few between, who are willing to engage in like long form conversations about their policies and why they believe that. The response from what I can see has always been people on both sides saying, like, even though I might not agree with your policy, I do. I see where you're coming from and I understand better. And I think that is what moves things forward is it, like that is a part of compromise that I think we need to I think politicians need to focus on is even if your stance doesn't change, like even if you still say no to student debt, you need to explain here's why I said no to forgiveness or here's why I said no to
what's the forum for that nuanced intellectual conversation that
Relevant Magazine.
Well, I know, but I'm saying like
say podcast.
Nobody engages that stuff. Podcast. People want confirmation bias. They want to listen to the echo chamber of their own perspective. Nobody wants to stretch themselves. Nobody wants to be uncomfortable. And there's no forum for that.
I don't know. I do think there are, when you look at, you know, and again, there's some controversial names out there that I know people, you know, have issues with. But if you look at people like the Lex Friedmans on, you know, kind of leaning right, or even like
Andrew Ezra Tate, Klein's, like kind of leaning, he's a good guy,
or the Ezra Klein. Well, Lex Friedman's an MIT neuroscientist, but I think he's known for being a little bit more, you know, right of center. Or you look at someone like Ezra Klein from the New York Times, who's a little left of center. Both of them host regular, deeply engaging conversations with people from across the ideological and political spectrum that I feel like you can, to Emily's point, at least gained some nuanced understanding of what that person's position is in a non-confrontational format, right? Because social media encourages talking at people, where I do feel like those long-form conversation podcasts is more talking to people, talking conversationally. Again, Cameron, I think it's a fair point that we're more inclined to engage with kind of the shorter form content. But I do think there is an increasing movement on YouTube. You see a lot of young YouTubers hosting long form conversations, you know, and in podcasts where, you know, people who might in a previous generation be pretty ideologically entrenched, especially even when it comes to their guest list, are kind of opening it up to, you know, interesting. Malcolm Gladwell is another example, right? The guy's a constant moving target and regularly hosts, you know, interesting conversations, you know, in his podcast feed with people that think wildly different than him because there's a genuine intellectual curiosity of how that person developed their ideas, you know?
I also think there's always going to be someone who like I know I was this person in my friend group and there's other people I've met, but like I'm the person who I will sit down and watch the 3-hour conversation because I want to know both sides of the issue. Like I want to understand that. My friends don't necessarily have the patience to do that, but they do want to know that. So then we will talk about it. So then it's like, I become the person who can sort of like pass on that information. So I do think that I think there is a desire, especially among younger people, to understand the nuances, understand both sides. Whether or not they have the discipline is like a different topic. But I think that desire is there. And I think we, if we can figure out a way to reach that, that's great. But I think it's wrong to say that like people don't want that nuance. I think they do. They just don't know how to access it, or again, don't have the patience for it.
But if it's an issue that you already have a perspective on, that's okay. If somebody's talking about something where like, I don't really have a dog in the race and it's an interesting societal question and there's two perspectives, yes, I'll listen to the nuanced conversation and draw my own conclusion. But if it's something that you feel strongly about or you have like conviction about, like talking with somebody who's sees it completely different than you, most people will not engage that. I even remember back in like the 90s when growing up in the church, like the church would have like a debate between a creationist and an evolution guy. It'd be like a special event, you know, and the church would come, and it's like, they're not coming to be open-minded to learn more about evolution. They're coming mm-hmm. so the creation guy would win, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you, mm-hmm. even if you're engaging the topic, if you have a conviction about the topic, you want to win. You know, you're not interested. You're not truly going to be open to the other perspective.
Yeah. I think that's totally a fair point, but like I said, I do think there are interesting outliers that in kind of is particularly podcast. Like I said, I'll go back to like the Ezra Klein show, the New York Times podcast. You know, he recently had an episode where it's a libertarian and I debate the debt ceiling, right? But it wasn't them shouting at each other. It was them approaching the topic with genuine interest to understand the flaws in their own thinking. Again, you can't, I don't know. I don't think there's an anecdote to the problem you're referencing. I think that's human nature.
Right. It is. It's
confirmation bias, yeah. You know, but I do think the more people are willing to have a fair-minded approach to those conversations, the better. There's no way you can do it, but there are voices out there that I do feel like are making a genuine attempt, and I do think some of their platforms are growing, you know?
Yeah, and we do too. We try to always find that third way in a lot.
Yeah.
All right, well, that'll do it for Relevant Buzz. Make sure to check out relevantmagazine.com every weekday, where we're covering the intersection of faith, culture, and everything in between. Thanks, Emily. All right, stay tuned. Up next, Upper Room joins us. Listening to Grant Perez and Cave Town. The song is When We Were Younger.
Well, today's episode is brought to you in part by Sanctuary Mental Health Ministries. Mental health and faith are big topics to cover, even more so when you're talking with teenagers. The Sanctuary Youth Series helps youth leaders, pastors, teachers, and parents break it down, covering topics like a theology of mental health, emotions, stigma, recovery, friendship, self-care, and more. The Sanctuary Youth Series is an 8-week resource designed for 11 to 15-year-olds. Help the next generation experience the church as a supportive space for mental health. Run the Sanctuary Youth Series today at sanctuarymentalhealth.org/relevant. Again, that's sanctuarymentalhealth.org/relevant. Are you a recent college grad or about to graduate from college and have no idea what's next? Check out the Global Ambassador Program, or GAP, with ELIC. GAP is a professional development program that will help you gain the tools you need for a lifetime of impact. Be immersed in the cultures of Thailand, Tunisia, or Uzbekistan for 9 months as you take language classes, grow in your faith, and serve the local community alongside a team of other Christian young professionals. And get this, ELIC recently opened applications for 2026. You could be on a plane next summer, impacting lives and reaching your fullest potential. To learn more about GAP and take the next step, go to elic.org/relevant. That's elic.org/relevant.
Well, our guest today is Upper Room. They're one of our favorite worship bands. They just dropped a new live album called Moments 11. Moments 11. I guess they have 10 previous moments before this one.
I wish they just jump started it right at 11. You know, just why not?
Skip the 10.
And it's Moments :011. So it's like they're planning to have hundreds of moments. So we're only at 11. We talked to Michael Miller, who started the Dallas-based ministry, and Jonathan Lewis, Upper Room's worship director, about how a small prayer group became a global movement, how their desire is to get back to God's original design for the church through simple but powerful worship and creating an authentic culture of believers. Here's our conversation with Upper Room.
You know, I'm curious, what is the difference between like a Moments album from Upper Room and maybe a different album that y'all might put out?
Yeah, our Moments album are really the core of who we are, really true to who we are. Like they run the gamut from one person on an instrument in the prayer room. Another track might be, you know, what we do on a Sunday, or weekend service. But we would say like our Moments are really just our culture, who we are day in and day out, whether anybody's in that room or the room's full. Yeah. And other albums that we've done in the past, you know, have been songs that we've actually curated, written. Most of those songs have come from the prayer rooms, spontaneous songs that have been birthed out of prayer room. I would say our Moments are probably who we are day in and day out. It's just our culture.
I'm always curious, like anytime you put out an album, what is your hope for people listening to it?
Michael Miller has a whole story about that.
Oh.
I don't know if I have a full story, but I can give you an answer. You know, if it's transformed us, if it was something that God anointed in a moment, we want to share that. And so our thought is, if it transformed our community, we really wanted to give people a window into what God's doing in our culture. The story of the Upper Room, it started out as a prayer room, and we didn't do media for 7 years. So we didn't have a YouTube channel. We didn't do podcasts. We didn't even have social platforms. It was really clear in the early days, the Lord was planting something unconventional. And so none of those, you know, quote unquote strategies we employ. And it became a sweet spot for us, like kind of being this obscure, unknown place. But in our city, people knew that it was daily prayer and people were encountering God. And then in 2017, a friend of mine just shared a word that he thought he had from the Lord about us using media to bless Gen Z, specifically Gen Z and millennials. And so we've kind of looked at it as a drip, in the sense of like an IV. If you see an IV that drips medicine into someone that's sick, we really felt like that was the strategy to take moments of our culture and drip them online. And like our third one went bonkers, and it was to our surprise, because we were just kind of being obedient in what we felt like the Lord was calling us to do. And we kind of caught the tiger by the tail. You know, we've been trying to catch up to that ever since, and just trying to stay pure to the simplicity of the presence of the Lord and hosting him and ministering to him. And now seeing that the Lord has really highlighted that, I think, for the larger body of Christ. And he's used Upper Room and other communities for that. But it wasn't something that we whiteboarded out. It really was just an organic discovery of the Lord's leadership and how, you know, now I'm seeing how strategic it was to touch millennials and Gen Z who are looking for that, who are looking for something authentic, not something that's manufactured, not something that's well produced. I remember one of our first Moment albums, we had a 52 minute song on there, and people were like, 52 minutes, what are you doing? And I was like, well, this is just who we are. Like, it's a representation of what happens daily. And so it's been a giant experiment. It still is. And you mentioned Moments 11, which was the last one. And I think it's one of the purest offerings that we've given in a while. I've been listening to it now for 6 months. I listened to it this morning. I listen to it almost every day. There's a couple of songs on there that just, the sauce doesn't run out. It is like, it is just so pure, and it pierces my heart even today, and I hope it does that for others.
You gave everything to make us your resting place. Oh,
guys emphasize a lot that worship is more than music, which I think is an idea that a lot of people maybe don't think about a lot of times growing up, especially in the church. Like, we think of worship as it's the three songs you sing before a sermon on Sunday. And so I'd love to give you both just kind of a second to, can you kind of unpack that idea of like, what do you mean when you say worship is more than music?
Well, I think I'll start and then another answer. I think one of the real core values for us is just a house is every time we gather together, we bring something to the Lord. And when we come to him, we don't want to come empty handed. So we bring an offering of thanksgiving. We bring an offering of praise to him. And one of the things that we have noticed about the Lord is that when we bring an offering to him of thanks, he's actually so attracted to that. I mean, like, you look at like that throughout the Bible, he's so attracted to offerings. And so what we've noticed in just gathering around him is that when we come with an offering of thanksgiving in our hearts, one, it begins to just like deal with your soul, deal with soulish things. You know, like, I often refer to it as when we come in with thanksgiving, it actually washes us of soulish earthly things. So when we're thinking about our own finances and how we're, let's just take finances for example, when you come in, you're thinking about your lack of finances, but you come in with thanksgiving, thanking him for being a provider, you actually wash yourself of thinking about your own lack of finances, and he shows up in such tangible ways. We call it, he shows up as the author of our faith. And so he comes in and we circle around what he is, the person that he is. I think what we're doing, what we're finding corporately is what I have found personally is, man, my heart begins to be transformed when I come to him with an offering, with no expectation of him changing that, but he does. He comes and he authors faith for himself in my heart, that ultimately it's our motto, that he begins to transform us in his presence. It's one of the real tangible things that I've noticed in our community. I think you can tell that. I think when we talk about moments, we talked about that earlier, like, what you're picking up on is actually there's faith on this album. There is faith behind what someone is singing. When someone's just singing, whether they're the only person in the room or the room is full, they're singing, and they're singing full of faith unto a God who is actually the author of that faith.
I think worship is one of those words that's elastic. And what I mean by that is, you may have a definition, I may have a definition, and Jaylu may have a definition, and they're all right. But I think really honing in on, you know, how we have chosen to define the word, and we define it as agreeing with who he is. So agreeing with who Jesus is, according to the Bible, says that he is. So not all songs that we sing are worship songs. There's intercessory songs, there's praise songs, but, you know, a lifestyle of worship is aligning up with the nature and character of who our God has told us that he is. So Jaylu mentioned provider. So one of the ways we worship him is by agreeing that he's a provider. We're not going to enter into fear. We're going to align our hearts and our mind with that reality and live a life that submits to that nature. And I think one of the primary ways the Bible instructs us to worship, at least together, is through song. So song plays a vital role in that, because it's the way that we express corporately with a unified heart, unified mind, through words to him. But those words should impact our hearts to walk it out in our life. And so, you know, we present ourselves as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to the Lord, for this is your spiritual act of worship. And then we're transformed by the renewing of our mind. And oftentimes when we come into the place of prayer, come into the place of worship, you know, life attempts to redefine God. I think culture's attempting to redefine God. And he looks more like us than the God of the scriptures. And so what we've seen is that young people who come into an environment where there's agreement around the nature of God, in that culture, they're convicted about a life that's not submitted to that reality. And so while worship isn't music, man, he uses it. And we see in heaven that they're singing songs. So I know it's a crucial part to living out this life of worship, but I think it's an agreement unto who the Bible says Jesus is, the Father is, the Spirit is. And we've really honed in with our worship leaders, like, hey, this is more of a praise song, or this song is more about us than him. This is about what he does for us. But worship is agreeing with who he is. So we've really been meticulous about the words we put in our community's mouths, because it's an expression of their heart. Hopefully that'll be helpful for people listening. Just that definition, I think it can be a word that's interpreted in various ways.
That was Upper Room. Make sure to check out their new album, Moments 11. All right, stay tuned. Up next, it's your feedback. Listening to Husbands, the song is Can't Do Anything. So that makes sense. Husbands can't do anything.
Yeah, it makes
a lot of sense.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know this. It's a super group with Kevin James, Ray Romano, Tim Allen from Home Improvement. it's what's the super group of Phoebe Bridgers and
Boy Genius.
Boy Genius.
It's the Boy Genius of 90s yeah. sitcom dads. They can't get anything right.
Can't do anything, my husband's. All right.
Guess who locked themselves out of the house again and just have to sneak up through the window?
Feature from Homer Simpson.
What if you could change a child's life with just $10? Right now, thousands of vulnerable children in East Africa are suffering from jiggers. It's a painful, preventable parasite that burrows into their feet. Soul Hope is the only organization treating it through foot washing, medical care, and durable closed-toed shoes that protect kids long after treatment. $10 may not seem like much in today's world, but when we come together, those small gifts add up to big change. Join the 10 for 10 campaign. $10 protects 10 small toes. Visit soulhope.org/10 to give now. One small gift makes a big difference. Again, that's soulhope, soulehope.org/TEN. Today's show is brought to you in part by the new documentary, Buying Her. Why is sex trafficking a multi-billion dollar industry? Sex buyers. To end trafficking, we need to put them in the spotlight. The documentary Buying Her, created by the organization Exodus Cry, is a first-of-its-kind film exposing the truth about sex buyers. It captures the unfiltered stories of men revealing how they became predatory consumers and the booming sex trade, and how some of them found redemption. Buying Her strikes at the very heart of sex trafficking, and it's available to watch now for free at buyingher.com.
Okay, it's time for your feedback. I'm looking at feedback and I have no recollection of this, how we asked this question, but the question we asked you last week was, what's a lie you've told someone, but they still don't know it's a lie?
Emily, help me.
Margaret Harvey got the best one. I'm just gonna let y'all know that. I'm gonna let y'all get a context, but Margaret Harvey got the best one.
Jesse, do you remember how we got on this question?
I don't remember how we got it, but I do remember one of the anecdotes that I heard a story about someone who went to college and was joking around talking in a British accent, and people thought he was British, and it was too late.
Yes.
And they spent the whole freshman year having to fabricate a story about being from England.
Yeah.
You know, you just got in too deep too quick, you know. I can't remember how we got there, but I remember where it landed.
Yeah. All right. So you guys hit us up on Twitter at Relevant Podcast. You also responded to our threads at Relevant Magazine. Here's some of our favorite replies.
Margaret says, my husband and I told our kids Barney died so we wouldn't have to watch it anymore.
Oh, no.
That is brutal.
I like it.
Hey, look, I don't blame you, but dang.
Melody said she started a new high school and didn't have the uniform yet, so her dad wrote a note excusing her. She copied the handwriting. The school checked it by calling him and went on file to prevent against forgeries. For years, if I didn't want to do something, I just wrote myself a note. The reason I bring that up is because I did the same thing, Melody. And that was truly just because I would always forget to get my parents to sign things. So I made up a signature for my dad in like the seventh grade and just used that for the rest of my high school career. I think I did tell my dad and he didn't care.
I'm grasping the complexity of her deceit now. Dad gave her a real note. She said, this is the first time the school is going to see my dad's handwriting. I'm going to rewrite the note. Give the school my version of the same note. They check it with them. He said, yeah, I gave her a note. And she has her penmanship on file as her dad. That is brilliant.
Some forgers are playing chess.
She's evil genius.
She's playing chess out here.
Gosh. You know? I was a deceitful little jerk, but I didn't even think of something that complex. That is smart. Good job.
M. Lockwood Porter, which sounds, I'll be honest, like the name of like a James Bond villain.
M. Lockwood Porter.
Mr. M. Lockwood Porter.
No, yeah, one of Nick's characters, a new girl, one of his novels. It's Nick's character.
Julius Pepperwood, yeah.
Julius Pepperwood, M. Lockwood Porter. M. Lockwood,
yeah, did you read the new M. Lockwood Porter mystery novel? It's very good. I don't know how I feel about this, but listen, it's not me. It's M. Lockwood Porter. He said his best friend and him wanted to go to a Blink-182 concert in high school, but couldn't afford tickets. So we told everyone in our extremely Baptist Oklahoma town that God called us to spread the gospel at an evil secular concert, but we needed donations to get in. We turned a profit. Now, in M. Lockwood Porter's defense,
I love it.
He didn't say if he shared the gospel there.
I love it.
He could have.
Now that is when you're playing chess instead of checkers.
That's chess, boy.
That's checkmate.
Yes. Why do I feel like that's what a lot of people are doing today? Like, they're just
listen, I'm going to Jamaica to spread the... I know they have churches down there, but it's a short-term mission trip, and...
Of course, it is mission trip to Hawaii. Hawaii is one of the most unchurched places on the planet. Please give me money to go there.
I legit did go on a mission trip to Scotland, and people were literally like, Emily, are you really going on a mission trip? And it really was. Like, it was like partnering with the church, but... I had a lot of people asking me like if I was just trying to play for a free trip to Europe.
Were you like, you know, Christianity's been popular there longer than it has here?
I mean, we went to a church that was older than America.
you know that basically our country was founded by people from around that region sending missionaries over here.
Yeah.
Like, you understand that history, right?
Yeah.
All right. All right, that'll do it for last week's feedback. There's more where that came from if you want to check it out. Okay, it's time for this week's
editorial question of the week.
All right. So, you know, we spent the first 10 minutes of the show talking about Barbenheimer. So the question of the week, we want to know your perfect movie double feature. We talked about themed nights, but then Emily pointed out, no, we got to do the juxtaposition. That's what makes it interesting. Mm-hmm. So what would be your weird pairing, but perfect pairing for a theater release double feature? Hit us up on Twitter at Relevant Podcast. And you can also hit us up on Threads at Relevant Magazine. We're posting this question everywhere, so just find it and then reply when you see it. Okay, we'll read our favorites on next week's show. Well, before we wrap things up, I want to thank Upper Room for joining us. Make sure to check out their new album, Moments 11. It's really good. Also, make sure to check out the summer issue of Relevant. It's out now. You can read it by clicking the magazine tab right there at relevantmagazine.com. Features a great cover story with Lauren Daigle. We have amazing faith leaders like Christine Kane, Judah and Chelsea Smith. We have amazing think pieces, issues, music, you name it. It's in there and it's free. Just go check it out. Share it. Help us spread the word. Also, if you want to get the beautifully designed, enhanced digital edition of the magazine, you can get it as part of your Relevant Plus subscription. All you have to do is sign up right there at the Relevant Plus tab at the website. You get ad-free unlimited reading at relevantmagazine.com. You get an ad-free version of this podcast. You get an exclusive subscriber podcast and more. Plans start as low as $250 a month. It's the best way to experience our content. Go check it out. Also, if you like the music on the podcast, you can check out our Heard on the Relevant Podcast Spotify playlist. We update it every week. There's a couple other playlists that we update weekly as well. Just search for Relevant Magazine over on Spotify. Okay. On that note, we'll wrap it. I'm Cameron Strang.
I'm Jesse Carey.
I'm Derek Miner.
I'm Emily Brown.
We will see you on Tuesday. Have a great weekend, everyone. Get some rest. Rest up for your Barbenheimer.
Listening to the Relevant Podcast. Check out our features, interviews, and news updates every day at relevantmagazine.com. And make sure to follow Relevant on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the latest. For more great podcasts, browse the shows on the Relevant Podcast Network, which you can find at our site. And while you're there, don't miss the all-new era of Relevant Magazine. A new issue releases every other month at relevantmagazine.com.
It's a limoncello after you had the pasta.
Relevant Podcast Network.